Jeanine left more than half her steak and drank little of the wine. Then she wandered across the saloon to examine his collection of tapes. "Paganini's Capricci," she murmured. "Now I know you're a masochist." And then her attention was attracted to the neat square pile of the typescript on the shelf beside the tapes. "What's this?" She turned the first few sheets and then looked up at him. Those beautiful blue eyes in the once beautiful face that was now swollen and distorted with fat and speckled about the chin with angry little blemishes made his heart plunge. "What is it?" And then seeing his expression, "Oh, I'm sorry, it's none of my business." "No," he said quickly. "It's not that, it's just that I don't really know what it is." He couldn't call it a book, and it would be pretentious to call it a novel. It's just something I've been fiddling with." Jeanine riffled the edges of the sheets. The pile was over 12 inches deep. "Doesn't look like fiddling," she chuckled, the first time he had heard her laugh since their reunion. "To me it looks like deadly earnest." It's a story I've been trying to write down." "May I read it?" she asked, and he felt panic rising in him. "Oh, it wouldn't interest you." "How do you know?" She lugged the huge typescript to the table. "May I read it?" He shrugged helplessly. "I don't think you'll get far, but if you'd like to try." She sat down and read the first page. "It's still very rough. You must make allowances," he said. "Craig, you still don't know when to shut up, do you?" she said without looking up. She turned the page. He took the plates and glasses through to the galley and washed them. Then he made coffee and brought the pot to the saloon table. Jeanine did not look up. He poured her a mug, and she did not look up from the page. After a while, he left her and slid through to his cabin. He stretched out on the bunk and picked up the book he was reading from the bedside table. It was Crawford's Mariner's Celestial Navigation, and he began to wrestle distractedly with zenith distances and azimuth angles. He woke with Jeanine's hand on his cheek. She jerked her fingers away as he sat up hurriedly. "Oh, what time is it?" he asked groggily. "It's morning. I have to go. I didn't sleep all night. I don't know how I'll get through work today." "Will you come back?" he demanded, coming full awake. "I have to. I have to finish reading. I would take it with me, but I'd need a camel to carry it. It's so big." She stood over the bunk looking down at him with a strange speculation in those slanted dark blue eyes. "It's difficult to believe that was written by somebody I thought that I knew," she mused softly. "I realized that I really knew very little about you after all." She glanced at her watch. "Oh my gosh, I have to fly." She parked the VW under the mango trees beside the yacht a little after 5 o'clock that evening. "I've brought the steaks," she called, "and the wine." She came up the ladder and ducked down into the saloon. Her voice floated up to him in the cockpit. "But you'll have to cook them. I can't spare the time, I'm afraid." By the time he got down into the saloon, she was already seated and completely engrossed in the massive typescript. It was long past midnight when she turned the last page. When she had finished it, she sat quietly with her hands clasped in her lap, staring at the pile of paper silently. Then, when she looked up at him at last, her eyes were bright and wet with tears. It's magnificent," she said quietly. It'll take me a little time before I can get over it enough to talk about it rationally, and then I'll want to read it again." The following evening she brought a fat Cornish chicken. "It's range-fed," she told him. "One more steak and you'd start growing horns." She made coq au vin, and while they ate, she demanded an explanation of the characters in his typescript. "Was Mr. Rhodes really a homosexual?" "There doesn't seem to be any other explanation," he defended himself. "So many great men are hounded to greatness by their own imperfections." "And what about Loeb and Gula?" "Was his first love really a captured white girl? Did he commit suicide? And Robin Ballantyne, tell me more about her. Did she impersonate a man to enroll in medical school? How much of that is true? Does it matter? Craig laughed at her. It's just a story, the way it might have been. I was just trying to portray an age and the mood of that age. Oh, yes, it does matter, she said seriously. It matters very much to me. You have made it matter. It's as though I am a part of it. You have made me a part of it all. That night, when it grew late, Craig said simply, I made up the bunk in the forward cabin. It seems silly for you to drive all that way home. She stayed, and the following evening she brought a valise, which she unpacked into the stowage of the forward cabin, and they settled slowly into a routine. She had first use of the shower and heads in the morning, while he made the breakfast. He did the cleaning and made up the bunks, while she did the shopping and any other errands for him during her lunch break. When she arrived back at the yacht in the evenings, she would change into a T-shirt and jeans, then help him with the work on the yacht. She was particularly good at sanding and varnishing. She had more patience and dexterity than Craig did. At the end of the first week, Craig suggested, It would save you a bundle if you gave up that flat of yours. I'll pay you rent, she agreed, and when he protested, Okay then, I get the food and liquor. Agreed? That night, just after she had doused the gaslight in her cabin, she called through the dark saloon to his stern cabin. Craig, do you know, this is the first time that I feel safe since... She did not finish. I know how you feel, he assured her. Good night, Skipper. Yet it was only a few nights later that he came awake to her screams. They were so anguished, so tormented and heartrending, that for seconds he could not move. Then he tumbled from his bunk and sprawled on the deck in his haste to get to her. He fumbled and found the switch to the fluorescent tube in the saloon, and then clawed himself down the companionway. In the reflected light from the saloon, he saw her crouched in one corner of the cabin. Her bedclothes were hanging in untidy festoons from the bunk, her nightdress was rucked up around her naked thighs, and her fingers formed a cage across her terrified, contorted face. He reached for her. Jan, it's all right, I'm here. He wrapped both arms around her to try and still those dreadful cries of terror. Immediately she turned into a maddened animal, and she flew at him, her nails slashed down his forehead, and had he not jerked away, he would have lost his eye. The bloody parallel wounds ended in his eyebrow, and thick dark blood oozed into his eye, half blinding him. Her strength was out of all proportion to her size. He could not hold her, and the harder he tried, the wilder she became. She sank her teeth into his bare forearm, leaving a crescent-shaped bite mark deep in his flesh. He rolled away from her, and instantly she crawled back into the corner and crouched there, keening and blubbering to herself, staring at him with glittering, unseeing eyes. Craig felt his skin crawl and itch with dread and his own horror. Once again he tried to reach her, but at his first advance she bared her teeth like a rabid dog and snarled at him. He rolled out of the cabin and dragged himself into the saloon. Frantically, he searched through the tapes and found Beethoven's Pastoral. He pressed it into the slot and turned the volume up to the maximum. The magnificent music swamped the yacht. Slowly, the sounds from her cabin dwindled into silence. And then, hesitantly, Jeanine came into the companionway of the saloon. She held her arms crossed over her chest. But the madness was gone from her eyes. I had a dream, she whispered, and came to sit at the table. I'll make some coffee, he said. In the galley, he bathed his scratches and bites with cold water and took the coffee through to her. The music, she started. And then she saw his torn face. Did I do that? It doesn't matter, he said. I'm sorry, Craig, she whispered. But you must not try to touch me. You see, I'm a little bit mad also. You mustn't try to touch me. Comrade Tongata Zabiwe, Minister for Trade, Tourism and Information in the cabinet of the newly elected government of Zimbabwe, walked briskly along one of the narrow gravel pathways that meandered through the lush gardens of State House. His four bodyguards followed him at a respectful distance. They were all former members of his old Zipra cadre, each of them hardened veterans whose loyalty had been tested 100 times. Now, however, they had changed the camouflaged dungarees of the Bush War for dark business suits and sunglasses, the new uniform of the political elite. The daily pilgrimage on which Tungata was intent had become a ritual of his household. As one of the senior cabinet ministers, he was entitled to luxurious quarters in one of the annexes of State House. It was an easy and congenial walk from there, through the gardens, past State House itself, to the Indaba tree. State House was a sprawling edifice with white walls and gables, arched in the tradition of the great homes of the Cape of Good Hope. It had been built on the instructions of that arch-imperialist Cecil John Rhodes. His taste for the big and barbaric showed in the design, and his sense of history in his choice of the site for State House. It was built on the spot where Lobengula's kraal had once stood before it was destroyed by Rhodes's marauders when they rode in to take possession of this land. Beyond the great house, not 200 paces from its wide verandas, stood a tree, a gnarled old wild plum, enclosed and protected by a fence of iron palings. This tree was the object of Tungata's pilgrimage. He stopped in front of the iron palings, and his bodyguards hung back so as not to intrude on this private moment. Tungata stood with his feet apart and his hands clasped lightly behind his back. He was dressed in a navy blue suit with a light chalk stripe, one of a dozen that Hawkes and Gives of Savile Row had tailored for him during his last visit to London. It fitted his wide, rangy shoulders to perfection and subtly emphasized his narrow waist and the length of his legs. He wore a snowy white shirt under it. His tie was maroon with the tiny buckle and bridge logo of Gucci, picked out in blue. His shoes were by the same Italian house, and he wore his expensive Western clothes with the same elan as his forefathers had worn the blue heron's feathers and royal leopard pelts. He removed the gold-rimmed aviator-type Polaroid glasses from his face, and as part of his personal ritual, read the inscription on the plaque that was riveted to the railings. Beneath this tree, Lobengula, the last king of the Matabele, held his court and sat in judgment. Then he looked up into the branches, as though in search of his ancestor's spirit. The tree was dying of old age. Some of the central branches were black and dry, but from the rich red soil at its base, new shoots were bursting into vibrant life. Tungata saw the significance of that, and he murmured to himself, "They will grow as strong as the great tree once was, and I also am a shoot of the old king's stock." There was a light tread on the gravel behind Tungata. He frowned as he turned, but the frown cleared as he saw who it was. "Comrade Leila," he greeted the white woman with the pale, intense face. "I am honoured that you call me that, comrade minister." Leila came directly to him and held out her hand. "You and your family have always been true friends of my people," he told her simply, as he took her hand. "Beneath this tree, your grandmother, Robin Ballantyne, met often with Lobengula, my great-great-uncle. She came at his invitation to give him advice and counsel. Now I come at your invitation, and you must believe that I will always be yours to command." He released her hand and turned back to the tree. His voice had a quiet, reflective quality. "You were with me when the Anlimo, the spirit medium of our people, made her final prediction. I thought it was right that you should be there when that prediction is brought to fruition."